Well, we're in the middle of our Lenten portion of our pilgrimage. We're still on pilgrimage, right? You've still got your guidebooks there. You've still got your passports. You can still get stamps in them. But during Lent, we take on certain practices or we give up certain things as part of that pilgrimage. And fasting is part of that. Now, you can literally fast from anything. You can give up anything. For example, when I'm out of the office, my vacation response, as it's called, usually reads, I am fasting from email. I consider that a spiritual discipline. I really do. Honestly. I fast from voicemail when I'm gone. So we can give up anything. Sometimes we take on practices. We take on reading a devotional book every day, or we take on a certain prayer practice every day. Not everyone should fast from food, okay? It's not healthy for everyone. But those who do fast do it for a variety of reasons. Some of us fast to lose weight, right? Some of us fast during a cleanse. I don't even really know what I'm talking about when I say that, quite frankly. Some of us fast to make a statement, as in hunger strikes in prison, to call attention to a cause or to call attention to a need or concern. Some of us fast to identify with those who don't have the choice to eat anytime they want to. Close to 30 of our youth and adult leaders have been doing that this weekend. Not simply to raise money to help feed folks, but also to experience just a little bit of what it's like to be hungry, in our case, by choice, so that we can identify and have a deeper empathy with those who are hungry and it's not their choice. So fasting in some way is to connect us with another, the experience of another. In the psalm this morning, it says, my soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints as in a dry and weary land. I don't know about you, but I have never been so thirsty that my flesh really fainted. I have never been so hungry that I really, really did not know where my next meal would come from. Now, I grew up poor by our standards, but I never went without food, and I never had to wonder if I would. There are people who do. There are people in this city who do. There are people throughout this country who do, and there are people across the world who do. And a part of the practice of fasting, it seems to me, is not simply to identify with the psalmist who is talking about that yearning for God and using thirst and hunger as a metaphor for wanting God with us, wanting God's presence, but also to understand a little bit better the plight of those who may go hungry over the weekend because the food they get is through the supplemental programs at their school, unless they have someone to pack food for them and send it home with them, even in Nashville. And to spur us to address some of those issues, as with the Tennessee Food Project, the Nashville Food Project. There is sometimes a great emptiness and hunger within us, and it's not just for food. It's not just for water. And we try to fill that hunger with all kinds of other things. We try to fill it with money, or we try to fill it with prestige, or we try to fill it with alcohol, or we try to fill it with sex, or we try to fill it with busyness. And no matter what we try to cram into that emptiness, it never is full. It's like a black hole of need. It takes in everything, and there is still that hunger. That's the hunger the psalmist is describing. That hunger for God's love, that hunger to know that we are beloved, sometimes because our parents didn't communicate to us that that we were beloved. Sometimes it's because our church did not communicate to us that we are beloved. In fact, gave us the opposite message. Sometimes it's because our culture does not communicate to us that we are beloved. For whatever reason, there is this emptiness, this yearning, this hunger or thirst, which seems to be an appropriate metaphor for what we experience. And yet we know that ultimately that hunger reaches out to be filled with something beyond our grasp. Others have recognized that too. I want to tell you about a woman named Mary McLeod Bethune. Some of you will know her name. She was born in the first decade after the Civil War. She was born free, but of former slaves. She still had to work the fields as a child, but she had one advantage. Because there were missionaries who felt that the freed slaves and their children deserved to be educated, that education was their ticket into a broader world, into self-sufficiency, those missionaries came, and she was able to go to school. She was able to learn to read and to write. And that was not simply her ticket to a larger world, but because they were missionaries, she was told for the first time, perhaps, that she was not three-quarters of a person, as the Supreme Court had decided. She was not half a person. She was not a quarter of a person. She was a beloved child of God, 100%. And when she recognized that schooling was an avenue not just to filling her previous ignorance, but to filling that empty space inside her, which was a yearning, a thirst, and a hunger to know that she was beloved of God, she began to teach herself. She taught with a woman named Lucy Craft Laney. Lucy Craft Laney had been a slave. She had learned to read and write, and she started a school for young African-American women, because she felt like in that day and time that if you lifted the women, that you would lift the whole community. That's still true in parts of the world where women are denied education, isn't it? Where young women are shot on their way to school for trying to be educated, like Malala, isn't it? She believed that if she could educate these young women, and one of those young women was Mary McLeod Bethune. She was her assistant. She learned from her to the point that she decided she would take on that calling for herself. She went to Daytona, Florida. She began her school. It was basically a school for young women, except she had a son by that time, and he went to school with the six girls who were in her school. She could only afford to buy a piece of property with a little house right next to the city dump. She had no funding. She had no financial backers. But she knew that there was a hunger and a thirst, a hunger and thirst in those children for knowledge and to know that they were beloved of God. But there was also a hunger and a thirst in those workers who worked at the dump. So she started frying fish and making sweet potato pies and on occasion making ice cream and selling that to the workers at the city dump, and made enough money to establish her school. Do you know many colleges that were started by selling pies? The school finally became Bethune College, an institution for young women. In the early 20th century, it merged with Cookman College, became coeducational, and became Bethune-Cookman College, now Bethune-Cookman University, still in Daytona. It was interesting that she had been influenced by Presbyterians and Episcopalians and others, but when Cookman, a Methodist school, merged with her school, she decided to become a Methodist, in spite of the fact that the Methodist Church was segregated. Even after 1939, when the Methodist Church The Methodist Episcopal Church, the Methodist Episcopal Church South, and the Methodist Protestant Church all came together. One of the compromises was that it would remain a segregated institution. There would be a separate conference for African-American members and clergy and bishops. She fought that her whole life. Just like she fought lynching, just like she fought for the education of everyone, especially young women, she fought the idea that the church that she had become a part of had separated the races, treating one race as somehow superior to the other, which, by the way, we continued to do until 1968. Remember, Brown versus Board of Education was 1954, desegregating public institutions. The United Methodist Church finally desegregated when it became United Methodist in 1968. We're a little slow on the uptake. We still are. We still have not fully integrated gay and lesbian folks. We still treat folks as if they are three-quarters of a person or half a person. Oh, yes, you can be with us, but you can't do this, you can't do that. I guess we're just slow learners. I'm grateful to God that God does still love slow learners, but I wish we'd pick up a little speed. She fought for all of those things. At the same time, she served as president of a college. At the same time, she served on Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Negro cabinet. She served young people throughout the country as a public official. Bethune-Cookman was a school that not only continued to operate during the Depression, but kept its accreditation throughout that whole period of time. She made sure that it did. As far as I know, and this was true, at least up to a couple of years ago, she is the only African-American woman who has a statue in Washington, D.C. Mary McLeod Bethune believed that education was not simply a doorway into a broader world, but it was a doorway into every single person recognizing that the hunger and thirst that they've had to be beloved can only be fully, completely filled by that love of God, and that education allows us to enter into that realm. And I have another story for you. Now, this is not an African-American. He's an African. His name is Augustine. He was born in what we would now call Algeria. He was a bishop in Hippo, which is in what we would now call Algeria. He was North African. Even though most of the depictions you will see of him makes him look like a white European, he was North African. He was the son of a Christian mother and a pagan father. The pagan father finally converted on his deathbed. He had the chance to get an education. And he was hungry and thirsty, but it wasn't for God. It was for excitement. He tells a story in his Confessions, probably the first autobiography ever, the first we know about anyway, about going out with some boys and stealing fruit from a farmer, not because they were hungry, but because it was forbidden. It was exciting to cross that line, to violate that taboo. When he went away to Carthage to study, to college, like many college students, if he had any religion, he lost it. He spent his time in partying. He loved wine, women, and song. He took a mistress. He had a child by that mistress. Although he didn't treat her very well, because when there was a 10-year-old heiress who he thought had better prospects, he decided he would set his cap for her and essentially abandoned his mistress and child. But you see, there was a catch. He had to wait 2 years to marry this heiress. He had to be 12 to get married. And in that two-year period, his heart was changed. Instead of marrying for money, he felt led to become a priest and later a bishop and one of the great teachers of the church and one of the great saints of the church. I often wonder how Christian theology would be different if Augustine had not lived such a raucous life in his youth. We'll never know. But he comes to a point in his life, and he records this in the Confessions, where he recognizes that he wasn't hungry for excitement. He wasn't just hungry for the thrills of the party. That there was an emptiness in him that could not be filled except by God. And he says it this way. Now, all the Confessions is addressed to God. But this particular prayer, he says, "Oh God, you made us, and we are yours. Our hearts are restless till they rest in you. Our hearts are restless till they rest in you." Could it possibly be that the reason Augustine could not truly love this mistress and child and abandon them was that he didn't feel loved himself? Even though he had a Christian mother, that he had never felt that he too was beloved. For all of his education, it took a life experience to turn him around and recognize that as unlovely as he was, and he was a wild and crazy guy, as unlovely as he was, God still loved him. We hunger and thirst for a lot of things in this culture. You know, all you have to do is watch the television or look at any magazine and somebody's trying to sell you something. Something that will fill that yearning, that will assuage that thirst, that will meet that hunger. But we all know that none of that really satisfies. That deep down we all want to be called beloved. And even when our parents don't call us beloved, even when the church doesn't call us beloved, even when our culture doesn't call us beloved, there is one reality in the universe beyond all of those who has already called us by name and called us beloved. And that is God. It's my belief that that hunger and thirst can only be met by one reality, God. So wherever you're hungering, whatever you're thirsting for today, don't settle for anything less than knowing that you are beloved of God, no matter what anybody in your life has said to you otherwise.